Rebag is a luxury resale marketplace. They have a curated collection of investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry. Each piece is carefully vetted and verified by experts. You can buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10.
Betches Media presents.
A lot of them aren't even pretending to be in charge.
Slow the testing down.
Remove him from office.
No justice, no peace.
Cast a vote that will make you proud.
The Betches Sup Podcast.
Will you shut up, man?
Listen.
Hello and welcome to the Betches Sup Podcast. I'm Amanda Duberman.
I'm Caitlin Bird.
And today we're so excited to be here with former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in the Obama administration, former mayor of San Antonio, former presidential candidate, and now fellow podcast host, Julian Castro.
Great to be with y'all.
How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good.
Here in San Antonio with my family, getting to take it a little bit easy these days.
Yeah, I know you're a parent to school-age children, so I wanted to ask you, first of all, how are you doing? Have your kids returned to remote learning?
Yeah, you know, my wife, Erica, is the lead coach for elementary school coaches in one of the, curriculum coaches in one of the school districts here in San Antonio. So she's been going to the office every day since August, mid-August, and I'm in charge of my kids' remote learning. Which is not a task at all for my 11-year-old, who's in sixth grade, but for my 5-year-old son, Christian, it's been an adventure. Yeah, you know, so far so good. You know, I think that the students are getting as much out of it as they possibly can. You know, I really admire the teachers who are scrambling like crazy, because in the school district that my kids go to, at least in my son's class, you know, the teachers are dealing with some students who are actually there in person, and then others, most of the students that are doing remote learning, and they're going back and forth. It goes without saying, it's not ideal for anybody. And I feel like as soon as we can safely get all of our kids back to school, I think all parents just about are ready for them to get back to school, because we want to make sure that they learn as much as possible. But it's given me a even greater respect for all of those teachers out there and staff who have had to improvise and, you know, do what they can to make sure our kids learn well.
Yeah. I was reading today that you actually skipped a grade in high school, right?
I did.
I was thinking, if I was your kid, I would say, Dad, you skipped a whole year. Do I really have to do a Zoom class? Do I really?
You know, my 5-year-old might get away with that since it's kindergarten. Yeah, who cares? You know, they're not even taking grades and not really even doing anything. No, I mean, somebody made a comment to me a couple of weeks ago how do you learn to read over Zoom? And, you know, it was such a simple comment, but it really kind of got my attention, because we're asking our kids to do a lot using new technology, and technology is wonderful, is powerful, helpful a lot of times, but you really do see that there's nothing like actually the traditional learning environment. So I hope that my son, stays on grade level, and I'm sure he's going to do great. He's going to do fine. But like every parent out there, you know, you start worrying about your kids and how well they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So you are a lifelong Texan, and there was a lot of excitement around the state this election, which saw record turnout in youth votes, specifically among young Hispanic voters. That was so exciting to see. You know, even though the state didn't flip blue this time, there's such a sense of inevitability about it. So I'm curious, what signs did you see during this election cycle that made you feel like Texas is really on that cusp and has a really exciting, inclusive future in national politics?
You can just tell in this state that something has changed during the Trump years, especially, that the state has accelerated from this place that was solidly red to one that has become more and more competitive. The other thing that I saw was about 20 polls in a row right before the election that had the election within the margin of error between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Now, at the end of the day, it was 5.8 points that separated Trump from Biden. So it wasn't as close. It wasn't quite as competitive as we thought that it would be. But hey, you know, 8 years ago, Barack Obama lost Texas in his reelection by 16 points. Hillary closed it to 9 points, and now it was 5.8 points. So there is no denying that Texas is moving in the right direction, that it's becoming more Democratic. And the question is, how do we build on that momentum? How do we close that gap and all of the organizing that has to go into making sure that we're able to win some of these races in 2022, 2024, and beyond that?
Yeah, actually, that segues really well. A lot has been made about the so-called, I want to say, Latino vote, and the dawning realization for many in our media that it is not a monolith. As someone who's been at the forefront of outreach to Latinx communities and called out the party's organizing efforts this last cycle, you highlighted some really great ones, but you also noticed where it could go further. What are the next steps for Democrats who see Latinas as a major part of the electoral future for the party? And what can these communities teach us about activating and retaining solidarity?
The number one thing is that it's not monolithic. And we've probably heard that word more in the last 3 weeks than we have in the last like 3 years, right? But it's not monolithic. We knew that before. But perhaps the reason that it became so apparent during this election was because of the expectations that when you had a president that had been so anti-Latino, had been so bad on immigration, on healthcare, on educational opportunity, on issues of equality in our country, a lot of people expected, like, hey, you know, I mean, certainly the Latinx community is going to go 90 to 10 against this guy. That didn't happen. Overall, the result that he got, the support that he got, was not that far afield from, you know, what you usually see in these elections. The Latino community remains a powerful and indispensable part of the Democratic coalition, and it helped to power Joe Biden to victory in places like Arizona, hold the line in Nevada, even growing communities in places like Georgia and Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. At the same time, there were these geographic areas like Miami-Dade County and border communities along the southern Texas border that, look, you know, people are scratching their head. And what we need to do is a deep dive and understand what happened there, why there was some backsliding, and then make sure that we're organizing 365 days a year on voter registration, on turnout, on messaging. And I think that we can reverse, you know, some of that backsliding that happened in those areas. But part of the beauty of the community is that it is so diverse. And you go to a place like South Florida, and it's wonderful because it's pan Latinx. Right, people from whose origins are originally Cuba, Venezuela, Mexican, Puerto Rican, so many different places. There's a beauty in that. And my hope is that if anything positive in terms of the media comes out of this, it's that the community won't be one-dimensionalized so much anymore. There's this one-dimensionalization where if you're Latino or Latina, you got here 5 minutes ago, first of all, you know, in 2 years, really a year and a half, it's going to have been 100 years since the grandmother that I grew up with here in San Antonio came to the United States. And you can write that story all over this country. The folks in the Latinx community have been contributing to the forward progress of our country in so many different ways for generations. And at the same time, you know, yes, there are folks who are essential workers, farm workers, folks who are fast food workers, meat plant workers. They're also doctors and engineers and teachers. And so I hope that people see the fullness of the community.
This week, President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris announced a number of national security picks. Their cabinet selections include Alejandro Mayorkas, a Cuban-American immigrant who, if confirmed, will become the first Latino to head the department. What do you think this and other selections say about the diversity of the Biden-Harris team and their views in putting together an administration?
I was happy to see that President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris are living up to their pledge to appoint a cabinet that looks like our country. They're still working on that, and I think it's going to become even more diverse. But these first few picks that centered around national security, they're people who are experienced. They are ready on day one to make a big impact. They also reflect the American experience. Alejandro Mayorkas, Deputy Homeland Security Secretary during the Obama-Biden administration, he's lived an immigrant's American dream story, two parents who immigrated as political refugees from Cuba along with him. So he's an immigrant and a refugee himself. Who better to understand that we are a nation of immigrants and to turn away from the cruelty of Donald Trump and his administration, the Stephen Miller approach, and instead embrace compassion and common sense when it comes to DHS and our immigration laws?
What advice would you have for incoming cabinet members, having been one yourself?
Well, I mean, my number one piece of advice is to rebuild the morale within your department, because for many of the departments in these last 4 years, they've lost so many people, and the people who are there, they didn't think that the folks at the top, whether it was Ben Carson or Rick Perry or any number of people, including a coal lobbyist head up the EPA, they didn't think that those folks really believed in the mission of the organization. So they're down. And these agencies, they just need to be rebuilt, you know, from the ground up. And folks need to be inspired again with that sense of mission of the organization. I mean, that would be my number one piece of advice. Don't just look outward and focus outward, whether it's with Congress or, you know, the perceptions or anything else. You're going to have to spend some real time focusing inward, because those agencies have been enervated over these last 4 years in so many ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What advice would you give people who see themselves a bit more progressive on issues than they're seeing reflected right now in the initial cabinet picks from the incoming Biden administration?
I'd say two things. Number one, there's no question this is a huge sea change versus what we had with Donald Trump. And we had the opportunity with these appointees to push. A few years ago, President Obama said something that I think is very true about politics and politicians, which is that you have to push them. You know, you have to make them sometimes uncomfortable and to go places and support policies that they may not naturally be inclined to do, but you're able to prevail because of your organizing and your pushing. And I think of those dreamers from a few years ago that did that with DACA and DAPA especially. And so that would be one, is this is not an ending, it's a beginning. The election was not an ending, it's a beginning. Keep pushing, keep organizing. And then secondly, he's not done yet. These are just these were the first few picks. These were the national security picks, defense and UN ambassador and a number of others. And there's a whole range of other policy areas. It's going to be important for the progressive voice to be reflected in some of those picks, because without progressives, we wouldn't have President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris. And you need to keep that coalition strong going forward.
Yeah. And I believe, speaking of sort of more progressive movement and then over the next 4 years, I believe your brother is in the running to lead the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And I think he would be the first Mexican-American to do so, we're speaking about how obviously Latinos are not a monolith, and you know, one really exciting cabinet pick that deals specifically with immigration isn't enough, of course. It's why do you think it's so important to have Latino representation in all areas of our national government?
Yeah, well, I'm proud of my brother, Joaquin. You know, he's a subcommittee chair on the Foreign Affairs Committee, and he's dedicated a lot of time and effort to really understanding the issues and being a leader on that committee. I think he'd make a great chair. Obviously, I give him my support.
Yeah,
not like
I
that
gotta
never
say,
in question.
I went to your Twitter feed and you had retweeted the tweet about the news story about it twice. So I was like, he's excited.
Yeah. He's also, you know, and we'll see how it goes. I think that he can win, but
yeah,
you know, he's also doing something that I don't think has been done very often or maybe ever before, which is that he's opening up the process from this, just this back room, just, hey, backslapping, support among colleagues model of appointing committee chairs who are, or electing committee chairs who are so powerful in terms of what actually happens on policy, opening that up by seeking the support, you know, the engaging outside groups, seeking their support, shining a light on the entire process. So win or lose, what he's done, I think, actually should be emulated going forward and should become a new model for how these committee chairs come to office. Having said that,
yeah,
I mean, I think representation does matter in every way. It's important, you know, for folks to understand that they can be anything and do anything. When I was running for president, it meant a lot to me to know that when I was standing on that debate stage, that there were a lot of little Latino boys and Latina girls who were watching and thought, oh, you know, I can do that one day. I can run for president. I can be president. At the same time, representation is not the only thing. You know, my mom was a Chicana activist, and it always strikes me that there was a time when, I'll just speak for the Mexican-American community here, when we thought that it would be enough to elect people that look like us. That in and of itself is not enough. What you really need are, you need people that are going to make the right decisions, make the right investments, you know, it's great to have both of those things, right? To have representation and have people who are going to make the right decisions and investments. If you have to choose one, I think that you choose people that are going to make the right investments and the right decisions. But the good thing is that we have such a plethora of talent out there who represent different communities that I think we can have both. We can have in so many of these positions people who are first, who reflect the diversity of America, and who are also going to have the courage to make, you know, tough decisions, but important decisions, especially for the most vulnerable communities out there who too oftentimes get overlooked. They get neglected. They don't have their lobbyists, you know, whining and dining folks in DC or in state capitals. You know, they don't have a voice, but they can have one if they have the right people in there.
Right. So in addition to parenting during a pandemic, you're also relatable in the sense that you started a podcast in 2020. Can you tell us about Our America?
Yeah, you know, I'm excited about this podcast. We launched it in September, and the idea behind Our America is to really highlight the way that the American experience changes from one person to the next. Over the last 6 years, I traveled to more than 40 states, over 100 different communities, big and small. There were people's stories that really stuck in my head and that I thought, wow, you know, their story is so emblematic of other struggles that people are going through, similar struggles. And so I wanted to go and tell those stories. And it's been fantastic so far. Like, we told the story of these residents in mobile home park residents in Waukee, Iowa. Their mobile home park got bought out by a private equity group. The private equity group tried to jack up their rent by 69% immediately. And our story was about how they fought back to try and stave that off. We just did one on work that people are doing with homeless individuals who live in storm drainage tunnels that run underneath the Las Vegas Strip, right? These casinos that are worth hundreds of millions, sometimes billions of dollars. And here you have people that are sleeping, you know, on concrete in a drainage tunnel underneath them. And you've had people die in those tunnels when it floods. So those are the kinds of stories. And we try to make it, you know, not just descriptive, but also uplifting in terms of, hey, what can we do about this? So that it's not just, wow, look how bad things are, which is often true, but also, how can we be productive and actually change this? Because I think people want solutions. They want to know that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, speaking of the question we asked earlier about, you know, if you feel like you want to see really progressive change, I think I was listening to some of the episodes and they really are already sort of a guidebook, like really personal sort of accounts of the solutions and the paths we can actually take to make these changes happen. Our listeners might be lucky enough to have some time off in the coming days. If they want to go back and binge listen Our America, what are some of your favorite episodes in addition to the ones that you listed, would you recommend? I loved the interview with Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, that was, you know, of course, she and I became friends on the campaign trail. I was so proud to support her after I ended my my own campaign. I mean, she's just fabulous. And we had a great conversation about the future, about values, about what she hopes to see in the next few years. Folks should listen to that. We also did one actually on reimagining public safety and police accountability using data. There's a social scientist, Sam Singalwe, and I interviewed him, and that was a really neat and fascinating conversation that we had. Those are some of the ones that we did that people should listen to. This week, we're re-airing episode one, which was a conversation I had with my mother and my brother about our America, you know, our family's story in this country, because we wanted to lay the foundation if we're going to be talking about other people's stories about where I'm coming from. And so I hope folks will check it out.
Yeah, yeah. When I was listening to them, you know, a lot of them were recorded before the election. I was just so struck by the tone of possibility. There wasn't, you know, prior to November 3rd, there was, well, if things go this way, if things go that way, there was so much trepidation. But listening to them, it was just so motivating to hear. It's like, this is the path we're taking, and these are the steps we can take no matter what. And I found them really encouraging to listen to.
Oh, thank you for that. Well, it's exciting that that we're going to turn the page.
Yes.
And, you know, I think everybody was breathing a huge sigh of relief. Yes. And also, you know, you have that optimism in your heart and so much hope for the future. And so we're gonna keep listening and engaging and hopefully offering a positive vision with solutions.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time, Secretary Castro. Until the end of democracy, I'm Amanda Duberman.
I'm Caitlin Bird.
And this is the Betches Sup Podcast.
The Betches Sup Podcast is produced by Sean Kilby and Amanda Duberman. Our podcast managers are Mike Coscarelli and Sean Kilby. Social media by Amanda Duberman. Artwork by Brittany Levine. Be sure to follow us at Betches_Sup on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And send your emails to sup@betches.com.
Betches.